song, If You're Happy and You Know It.
If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, then your life will surely show it. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands.
Save the other verses for later, perhaps. I'm aware that as I'm sitting here listening to the prayer requests, there could seem to be something slightly tone deaf about talking about happiness. We're talking about a family who may be saying goodbye to their wife, mother. We're talking about the chaos and humanitarian crisis in Gaza, or the ongoing fear and loss of life that people in Ukraine live with, or just a long list of things. We recently had an experience. We were gone for 6 weeks. We went to Faith Builders. I was teaching a class, music class, music fundamentals. We lived in a little house, or part of a little apartment in a large house right up the hill from Faith Builders that they bought in the last number of years. Just a quick little walk down the hill to the campus. We didn't go anywhere. I think we went to Meadville twice in those 6 weeks. Well, 5 weeks. The sixth week that we took a trip down to New Holland to visit Aaron and Christy, and then came back for a curriculum review summit that Hannah and I were helping with, as well as Arlen and Brenda. So aside from, during the 5 weeks, I think we went to Meadville twice. We showed up, and there was about a foot and a half of snow, and it just snowed every day for a week and a half. I'm teaching a music class. We have a lot more I had a lot more time with my family than normal. I was able to go up the hill during the afternoon so that Hannah could go down and audit a class that she really wanted to take. I mentioned snow. Yeah. It was just almost going to be bitter if we traveled east and avoided the main snow event here, but thankfully there was some there and some when we got back. Just sitting around after supper talking to friends that we've known for years. So do you think we were fundamentally happier during those 5-6 weeks? Yeah, we were. I'm not sure if that's the answer you expect, but at least we think we were. And we'll return back to this a little bit later. I want to go to the questions that I sent, and it's no problem if you didn't get a long time to ponder them or do any writing down of answers. I got feedback from a good number of you, and I appreciate that, as well as some book suggestions and things like that that I do want to share at the end. So just to reiterate some of the questions, some of them we'll save for a little bit later, but I asked the first one. I just want to hear responses. In your experience, are the Christians that you consider the most devout also happy? I didn't really say the most happy, but are they just categorically happy? Should it matter if they are or aren't or are not? I think we can identify in our family, friends, and our own selves periods of life or entire lives that are just, they're lived sincerely but really unhappily. And you think about that person, you don't think that's a happy person. Does that matter? Does God want us to be happy? What were your thoughts on that question? If you just speak up loudly, unless you go on for more than half a minute, then the mic will make it to you anyhow. But just try speaking up loudly. If there's short answers, we'll see if we can do it without the mic. I'll repeat it so that everyone for sure hears. It's very important that we be joyful. It's awfully nice if we can also be happy.
Do some people express their happiness more than others?
Do some people express
that person is happy or he isn't happy?
Do some people express their happiness more than others? I'm reminded of a little bit that Mark Lowry, a Christian singer and comedian, says that he remembers growing up around these people, you know, church-going people that would say with a dour face that I have been a Christian for 43 years and it has been the most joyful experience of my life. And he was thinking, you need to tell your face. So maybe they express their happiness differently. Other comments, does it matter? Are Christians happier? Or the most devout Christians, are they also the most happy? Or is that an unnecessary correlation to try to notice?
Who's the control group?
And how do you even measure that? So I would have thought about this question as just kind of a, what's your gut answer when you think about other people or yourself? Am I happy? And does that matter? But yes, good question. It's hard to set up a study like that within a week, or I would have done it probably, but.
Joy is the fruit of the Spirit. That is that you're reaching for something
good. Are joy and happiness different? Raise your hand if you think you would say they're different things. Arlen's going like this, so he has to say what he's thinking.
I think it's important to recognize that happy can be used in different ways. The being blessed.
Yeah.
That term actually means happy, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. And I haven't prepared how to define happiness in that way, but there is a sense in which I think happiness. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I did kind of pushing the two apart a little bit in my questions on purpose, because I think sometimes we quickly lump them together and move on to joy, and I'm not trying to pit them against each other, but we mean something slightly different when we say one or the other. Well, let's move on. We can come back to some of this. Can science teach us anything about happiness in relation to what we can come to understand, in addition, sorry, to what we can then come to understand simply by pursuing God? Is there something science can tell us about, or like just the observation of human behavior, if we get tripped up on the word science, when it comes to behavioral science, you're just studying how humans behave, and you set up studies to rate people's happiness, which is the only way you can do that. Not quite the only way, but mostly the only way you can do that is what do people think they are. There are also studies where they will analyze every muscle of a person's face as they react to something, because it is somewhat telling. But mostly you're just studying human behavior. Is there something science can teach us that might be in addition to what you can come to understand simply by studying Scripture? If not, why do you think that? And if so, do you think of examples? Not necessarily expecting to hear examples from you, but what was your gut reaction to that question? John, go ahead. Mike is incoming.
In the past, I've run across a study where they measured the impact of offering someone or a group of people many, many options to choose from, and then measured their happiness before and after, and then another group had much more limited number of options. And the fairly strong conclusion of the study was that more options did not equal more happiness.
Mm-hmm. We looked for peanut butter in Europe, and there was every flavor of Nutella available. Somewhat ironic, considering Europe tends to be ahead of us in health consciousness, but we were happy because we found one peanut butter in Aldi. And then I came around the corner in Walmart after we got back home from Europe, and there were two kinds of Nutella and 53 kinds of peanut butter. And I thought, that might almost be too many, as much as, like, I was thinking of that study when I, or of that general idea. Someone, Arlen. Oh, there's a mic coming for you too, and then there's someone back there.
I thought maybe you were gonna talk about some of the brain measurement they've done with pleasure sensors and pleasure chemicals. That I think is also fairly measurable.
Mm-hmm. I think that behavioral science can have a lot to help to teach us. But one thing I've thought about is that if you are observing, if your knowledge comes from observing humans, you might not have the correct information to draw from that gives you something that we should be inspiring or aspiring to. You might not be able to see that in the general public, and that's where mm-hmm. biblical and spiritual knowledge can go beyond yeah. that.
Anyone else? So it's connected to the next question. Go ahead.
Since we are made in God's image, and I think it's very true that to know God is to know ourselves, and we cannot know ourselves without also knowing God. So I guess I just find it hard to say that studying human behavior isn't in some ways also studying God, but obviously that can, you can look for the right thing and get to the completely wrong conclusion. So I think out of context, it's still not, science isn't necessarily helpful either.
Mm-hmm. I will get to some sort of a attempt to summarize or to bring proper hierarchy to these things. But I'm okay kind of sitting in some uncomfortable things where we're not sure if we're comfortable saying that science can teach us something that we might not come to learn otherwise. Now, I'll say this much, though. It's a different thing to say, if science tells us something about human behavior that seems contradictory, that we view it with deep suspicion. That's a different thing than saying, science can't teach me anything that I didn't already notice in my read-through of Proverbs or something. So, I listened to most of a podcast called The Happiness Lab by Dr. Laurie Santos. I'll mention it again at the end. It's worth listening to, aside from the annoying fact that there are ads in the podcast, even though I have Spotify Premium. But that hurt my happiness just a little bit listening to it. So I learned things in that. Nothing was just mind-blowingly different than I had thought before, and nothing made me say, huh, that's not what I think we understand from the Bible. It all connected. You go, oh yeah, that does make sense. But not everything in there was something that I, oh yeah, we talk about that all the time. Sometimes it's stuff that's a little bit not as obvious as others. And other stuff we say, well, yeah, that's kind of obvious. Nothing contradicted what we know. And I think it was, so far, what I managed to get through, it was a helpful perspective to say, yes, that is something we know to be true about God and about humans, but I haven't really thought about it that way. One more question that was not in your... the next question, which connects to that, and I don't think we'll spend much time on this now, but I asked, is happiness something that can or even should be pursued? If so, what boundaries or parameters should be kept in place? Is it just the side effect of other things being aligned? We're probably more comfortable latching onto that and saying, rather than pursuing happiness as the thing, to be aware. If not, if we should not pursue it, how is it different from pursuing other mental health or physical health? So I recently committed, as in paid them $350 plus tax, to do Bike Across Kansas, but I do not intend to do Bike Across Kansas with my winter physique. So I would like better cardiovascular health, or whatever term you want to use. But I can't actually go grasp it. There are only other things I can do to improve my health. And I think that can be a helpful way to start thinking about our pursuit of happiness. It can be a thing I pay attention to. What does the scale say, or how far can I run before I need to stop and rest? But I have to do other things that are foundational to how God made our bodies to work. Here's a few reflections that I wrote down earlier when I started thinking about this topic. I feel like sometimes we go right to true joy when we mention the word happiness, and then we quickly conclude, rightfully so, that true joy comes from true surrender or something of that nature. And I want to make clear, I'm not in the least suggesting that is not the everything or the primary truth to keep in mind, the overarching thing or the foundational truth, that we pursue God first of all. And so we could just stop and spend the rest of the time talking about pursuing God. And I think that would be appropriate, but I think we often do that. And I think sometimes I feel like we say that and we go on to that, and that is the most important thing. But sometimes there are other things we might be missing about our lives that we could come to understand just through a pursuit of God, and many people do, but some of us don't. Some of us don't make the connection that this is a happiness robber. And so sometimes talking about it as a symptom of other things that may not be lined up with God's design can be helpful. And I'm thinking especially about patterns and habits. I haven't employed all of the patterns and habits that I've been thinking about, but I've been thinking about the patterns and habits and how important that is in shaping not only our physiques, but our mental health and what we actually love. Some of the reading that we did in preparation for the summit thing we helped with at Faith Builders was from James K. A. Smith's book, You Are What You Love. And it was a really good refresher. He said, we don't do the wrong things because we don't know better, at least not usually. If you look at your life, when you fail to do what you know, it's not because of a lack of information. It's because your inner compass that inerrantly points toward what you consider the good life is not aligned, or rather, I should say it the other way around. What you know to do doesn't line up with where your inner compass really wants to go. So in order to calibrate those things, our love has to be shaped to be the thing we know to do. And that we shape our, that is shaped through the transformation of the Holy Spirit in us, but we also choose habits. I think there's a similar thing here I can maybe start using human flourishing instead of just happiness. If we are truly happiness, and Alvin, you were kind of mentioning this, I think, if we are truly happiest when functioning as God designed, then nothing we find about happiness and pursuing it healthily will be contrary to that central truth. But maybe we miss some of those how we are designed to be when we stop thinking about happiness after concluding that true surrender to God is the answer. Think about other areas of growth in our lives. We say there are responsibility to do something. We don't just decide, we don't just surrender our whatever it is in us that is bent and broken. We surrender that to God, and then we say we do things about it. We change our pattern of conversation if it's a relational sin. So if we can, through this evening, at least think about happiness as observing ourselves and saying, am I fitting into the mold that God actually designed for humans, or am I kind of violating that in some way by not living in a way that brings human flourishing? I'm just saying, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. I'm not sure why we sing that as children and not as adults. I think it feels a little shallow to us or something. I don't know what your reaction to that is. That's Danny talked on Sunday. I was pleased to hear what he was sharing on Sunday, because it kind of got me thinking more about some specific things. And he talked about the fake it till you make it thing that we don't really like. It feels inauthentic, and yet it's true about human behavior. A while ago, I was doing research. I Googled something about rated happiness in countries. Of the top 25, I'm trying to remember the numbers now, but of the top 25 that were listed, I think we were the 25th. That's why I was focusing on the top 25. None of the countries were involved in a current war that was heavily affecting home soil. A slight exception would be Israel. Israel was in the top five. But interestingly, all the other top five were cold Nordic countries. And so that was lending some credence to my belief that winter actually makes you happy. No, that's not really the real lesson there. But my question was, well, do these countries that consistently rank at the top, you know, top of the list of happiest countries, is that just because they've been conditioned to say, yeah, I'm happy? Just grin and say, I'm happy. Is that why? Or is there something that you can actually notice about their values that's different? In the case of, I believe it was Sweden, they list their commonly accepted national values as things like enjoying the small things, connecting with nature, and community. So all of us connect with something in that, but that's certainly not what we would list the United States cultural values as. So there's something instructive there. If as a country you say, yeah, I think that's what's important to us, or as a culture, whereas that's not what most of us would say as a broad culture we value. So it's not just being conditioned to say you're happy when you're given the survey. The side thing about the winter part is I noticed there's a book called, I believe it's called Wintering Well, where this lady spent a number of years traveling to countries that have winter for months, not just a few weeks come and go like we would experience here usually. And she found that, contrary to what you might think, if you live maybe at this latitude, people do not dread winter more the further north you go. In fact, there's almost a reverse correlation to some degree, where they say, yes, it's going to be dark and cold for 5 months. What are we going to do about it? And so they think about ways to use this time to rejuvenate. What are projects that we can do? Because you know it's going to happen. So it's like they say, you can choose to find joy in the snow, or you can choose to dread it. But either way, you have the exact same amount of snow in your life, unless you move, of course. There's some physiological things that you could point to, too. My wife pointed out that she has read that some of those countries consume a higher amount of fish than we do. And there can be some physical effects of diet that counteract seasonal affective disorder that we may not as much tap into. So a few quick things that I learned from this podcast that I found interesting. Nothing of this is earth-shattering to what you already know, but I think they're worth noticing. Little moments as opposed to big ones. They found again and again that the big moments, that you look forward to, they are actually happy, but people's happiness from that tapers off quickly. And the lesson there that they're learning is not that those things aren't important, but that happiness is like, it's a system. There's flow through it. And if you don't constantly feed on little moments that bring joy to you or happiness, then you get deflated. And so then you look back at that peak, mountaintop experience and say, was that not actually that great? And it was. It's just, it's one moment. So they say people who consistently rank themselves as happier than, or high on the scale, mention lots of little things. It's not the few big things. There's the same thing that happens with bad experiences. They said that we humans are very bad at guessing how happy how happy a mountaintop will make them, and how sad a low point will. Both of them taper off faster than what we think they will. Now, I don't know if that's encouraging to you or not, that just kind of average it out a little bit. But it points out that as long as you're not looking for a meaningful life from several important moments, but instead the little things, and I know it's starting to sound cliche that happiness is in the little things, but it's apparently true. So living a happy life requires lots of little inputs. There's something called silver medal syndrome, where they study the faces and reactions after an Olympic ceremony, or right at the moment when you find out where you rank, 1, 2, 3. Of course, the gold medalists are ecstatic. They've done it. They have peaked in their athletic world. You made it through all of the levels in your country. You made it to go to the Olympics, and you are the fastest person there that day. Silver medalists often have a visibly negative reaction to finding out they won silver, which wouldn't be that surprising except for that bronze medalists do not. They say it's fairly consistent with a lot of numbers that bronze medalists are happier about where they placed than the silver medalists. That's because the bronze medalist is not comparing himself to the two spots over gold medalist. He's saying, I got a medal. Those guys didn't. They just came to the Olympics and they competed, but I got a medal. And the silver medalist is thinking, that one small mistake and it would have been gold. So, and this is a quote from the podcast, instead of the silver lining, look for the bronze lining. As we often say, comparison really is the thief of joy. Money and misery. They did a study involving about 400 college sophomores in Yale back in the 50s, I guess. I didn't do the math on that, but JFK was one of them in that Yale class. And they also selected about that many from inner city, hard scrabble, more desperate conditions. And they studied these people through now 3 generations. The study kept getting passed on to new researchers. And it's one of the largest of its kind. And you're able to learn all kinds of things about people. And one of the very small sections of this was people's well-being. And they confirmed that, yes, the amount of income really does not correlate to the amount of happiness. And we go, yeah, we were told that. With the caveat that up to a certain level, it kind of does. So 70,000 is the figure I was hearing, and that's very relative to what your cost of living is and what your expenses are. But up to that point, people often do report an increased sense of well-being. They can make it. But above that point, they do not. There is no reported sense, a higher sense of well-being above that 70,000. So that gives you it's a relative line, but it's interesting. Aside from that, though, they really could not predict people's reported happiness based on their income. There's an interesting thing we do I say we as a culture, when we hear a rich and famous person complaining about their life, we mock that, say, what do you have to complain about? What we've just done is reinforced the lie that they shouldn't be unhappy because they have money. Now, if they're complaining about where to park their yacht, that's probably justified. But when we mentally say, that's so obnoxious, you have all that money and you're complaining about stress, yes, we've just reaffirmed the belief that they shouldn't have stress because they have money. There's a very interesting study they did where they took babies, like 6 months old, in a room, and they had two different groups. Babies, as they do, they would make something interesting and weird appear on the wall, like a character would pop out. The babies would get their parents' attention and point. And so one set of parents would look directly at the thing. The other set of parents would look at their child first, and then together they would look at the thing. The group of children whose parents looked directly at the thing they were pointing at quit doing it. So their conclusion is the reason children do that is not because they want their parents to see that thing, but because they want to share an experience with them. So their conclusion is that sharing experiences heightens them. An interesting example of that is they would do this chocolate tasting with people. It was all the same kind of chocolate. But they would give people this kind of chocolate, or give like three people sitting together this chocolate and have them taste it and talk about it and report how much they enjoyed the chocolate. And then they would give the same chocolate to other people that are sitting by themselves. And consistently, people enjoyed the chocolate much more when they were enjoying it with people. Very, very clear difference. The other interesting part about that is they had people share painful experiences like holding your hand in ice-cold water for as long as you can. And the reported pain was also greater with people, which seems counterintuitive to what we're trying to prove, but their conclusion was shared experiences do heighten the good and in some ways intensify the bad, but aid in bonding and potentially getting through that painful experience more quickly. So I don't know how you think about that kind of a thing in relation to grief. We all recognize that sharing that with people is significant. I don't know that it's more painful than if you were doing it by yourselves. It doesn't seem that way. But the lesson they took from that was you move on in a more healthy way and you are bonded as a group that had to stand there with your hands in cold water, conversing about how cold it was, probably. The last one I want to talk about is something that humans, whether you're an extrovert or introvert, tend to predict incorrectly almost 100% of the time. A few extroverts may get this one right. Small conversations with strangers, complete strangers. So think especially subway. You get on, you've never seen any of these people. When they tell control groups, or they tell groups, you don't talk to anyone, it's like, fine, I wasn't going to anyway. You do whatever you want, and you make a point of just small conversations with complete strangers. They always report a happier commute, even the introverts. This is where we predicted incorrectly. We say, oh no, that'd be awful. Some creepy stranger starts talking to me. And they said, no, it has to be within bounds. You don't just kind of, it's normal, natural conversations, not just walking up to someone as soon as you get on and start talking in their face. You sit down and you carry on pleasant conversation. This one is an interesting one for me because I used to do this a lot more and I'm not sure why I don't anymore. I suspect it has to do with smartphones. I am old enough to remember when no one had the rectangles in their pockets. The phones you had, they certainly weren't interesting to stare at. So on airplanes, maybe it's because travel was new, I talked to people and I had good conversations. It has become in our culture the assumption that the default is to be quiet and mind your business. It's a little bit almost on the edge of socially acceptable to strike up a conversation. That varies what kind of transportation you're in, definitely. So I'm thinking about that in relation to this topic when I'm sitting in break room the last couple of days. We tend to, people pull out their phones and you're scrolling through what the world has to tell you on Facebook or whatever social network. And I've learned some things about conversations to avoid. We've had lots of warm conversations, heated, warm, just fine line, that I didn't mind. Still friends with everyone, but then you start realizing that doesn't actually bring a lot of joy to some people. Maybe the three that are conversing and happy to converse. So I start going, okay, that conversation, those kinds of conversations really don't work. So we can talk about planes flipping over on the runway, which is at least better than just all staring at our phones, even if it doesn't bring us happiness. But one thing that was really fun in the last couple of days is I just addressed one of my coworkers to say, addressed one of my coworkers and said, I'm having this topic about the pursuit of happiness. Do you think? And then I would just start giving them questions. Well, that went through first break, lunchtime, was brought up again, first break today, lunchtime, little bits of it at least. And it pulled in more people than normally talk at lunchtime. It was enjoyable. It was not exactly a shallow or a light conversation, but I think we didn't do a poll when we left, but I think everyone was happier after break than before. That was an interesting social connection and something that we care about. So I'm going to suggest we could have an alternate title here. Instead of the pursuit of happiness, we could call it the happiness of pursuit. And I know it's an old joke about bachelors and life, liberty, and the happiness of pursuit. But there's actually some truth in this, and that is that we enjoy the pursuit of things because pursuits are made up of lots of little moments. When you catch the thing that you're pursuing, the reason it sometimes feels like, oh, well, the dog caught the car, now what, is because then that thing is done. Now, in the case of speaking of bachelors and the happiness of pursuit, once you have caught the partner, the pursuit does not need to end. If it does, then it's going to be exactly that. Okay, there's the high point, and then I have the thing, and I stop pursuing her a different way, definitely, but maybe not as much as we think sometimes. So just on that specific use of the quote, there's that the continued pursuit is still very much of a valid thing. And I think it applies to other stuff too. When I sometimes have a weakness of I guess I'm going to call them obsessions. So I haven't gone on an aviation kick for 3 years. I'm kind of proud of that, where I'm just, reading about certain kinds of airplanes and drawing airplanes. I haven't done that for a while, and I'm fine. I think my wife's fine kind of pushing that off for another year or two. But the reason I enjoy that is I'll kind of deep dive into something and learning about something and designing something that I'm not actually going to build. Some of the things I've spent time obsessing over, I might build someday. I've tried to watch that because it can become just that, an obsession. But there's something about pursuing a topic or a hobby that I think really does bring happiness to me in balance, what is healthy for other things in my life. A better title, though, I think could be The Pursuit of Wholeness. And this brings in what we're saying that, well, if God designed us to be this way, then it is noble to notice that. If God designed us to have small conversations as opposed to none, then that's a helpful thing to notice, that us buying into this isolation that is increasing in our society is not really embracing the wholeness of what God made us to be. So in that wholeness, there's definitely bigger things and smaller things. And I'm definitely not suggesting that we lift up pursuing happiness as the most important thing. Paul had sent me a message where he mentioned one of your friends had posted, see if I'm quoting this correctly, something like, daily reminder, inner peace above all. Is that right? Well, inner peace is important, but you can't pursue inner peace above all or you won't have inner peace. So we say wholeness as a Christian, as a child of God, made in his image, there is a hierarchy of what we pursue first. What is the first thing we pursue? Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. So that, and there'd be lots of different ways we could say that, but that is what we seek first. Wholeness means being as much as we can what God created us to be. So if I think back to our experience at Faith Builders, what was it that we could say, what were the factors that made it a happy experience for us? Well, I like snow. Hannah's happiness is not quite as tied to snow as mine is, but she really enjoyed just that winter wonderland. We just fluffy snow everywhere. We went on several walks. We weren't building houses in it. I know there's a big difference between those who enjoy it recreationally and those who have to deal with it. We went on walks in the game refuge. There's two bridges that go across a low part in the swamp, and it was completely untracked. Well, someone had gone through the center with cross-country skis, but the untracked part in particular was the handrails, which are 2x6, were stacked probably a foot and a half tall of snow. It was just lovely. We just thoroughly enjoyed that. A couple times, Hannah would take the boys on walks through the woods, especially after the snow melted down to a little more manageable depth, and Caspian would run around grabbing sticks and fishing in the creek and all kinds of things. We went on a lantern walk after dark through the snow down to where my sister Marilyn lives. We spend a lot of time with conversations. We spent way more time in conversations with friends than we do in our lives here, just because of the dynamics of schedule and everything. And we're right there by Faith Builders going down for meals and everything. I'm teaching a class on music, so teaching and music, both things that are important to me. Some of what I would say I'm made to do. We regular exercise. We're living in a fairly simple environment. Like I said, we didn't drive anywhere. I'm with my family more. So I can't bring all of those things back into my life here, but some of them we can. Some of them we can look at that and say, what about that life pattern that was very restful for us? What can we bring into our lives here? And that's one of my challenges for you, is if you take time to think back over the happiest times in your life, and there's nothing wrong with admitting that's not right now. It's also complicated to rate that sometimes, because if you think about your life now, if you have a wife and children, they bring so much fullness and richness to your life. But sometimes you can separate like that fullness and richness from, were there times where I just consistently felt more at rest in my heart, and maybe even found it easier to connect with God. If you think back to those times, can you identify factors that maybe you can make a part of your life today? There's not much I can do about this, about the fluffy snow everywhere. I know, and all of you are past that at this point, so I won't spend too much time on that. The friendship factor, the conversations, that's difficult to do with the way we live our lives, and we have families. We don't live on a compound. I don't know that anyone's been suggesting that. What are ways that can be brought into our lives more than it is? There are other times I could mention that I think I felt just a sense of simple happiness more quickly, and I identified one factor, and one of them is I had work to do. I just did it. There wasn't really much financial concern to worry about. The one example was when I lived in Nevada for 2 years, I made very little money. So I just didn't worry about that most of the year, most of the month, because there wasn't a paycheck till the end of the month. I was farming. I loved it. I'd get up at 2 o'clock and go bale hay or whatever it was and watch the moon come up over the mountains. And I was lonely sometimes, so that's where I'm thinking about that time in my life and go, well, the thing of human connection was a little weak there. Every Sunday morning through most of the year, I would drive to the mountain 15 minutes away and hike up about a 1,700-foot peak. It wasn't really the main mountain ridge. Hike back down, go back home, go to church, and that was my Sunday routine for a while. And I definitely would do that if we had a 1,700-foot peak in my backyard, just to be clear. I hope I would. Take a few minutes and think about community reflections. So I would challenge you to do that for yourself. Think about your life as you notice patterns of, we could use terms like more restful in your spirit, whatever, if happiness word makes you uneasy. But I think we can separate that there's a greater sense of well-being sometimes in life than others. Are there things I can learn from that? Are there things that I just keep charging on and doing in my life that are really militating against the wholeness God would have us live? Ministry is taxing. Family is taxing. I'm not suggesting we just back off those things because they pull a lot out of you. What about as a community? Are there things that we can do that could increase the well-being in each other's lives? There are things you think of.
Well, I think our taking time in our small groups is an excellent way to. I mean, some of the best times I can think of are the times we spent playing bocce ball or whatever, just being together. Mm-hmm. I think there is a component of joy that we ought to experience in community that sometimes we don't. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to have those times where we're serious or spiritual, we talk about important things, but
I would say that just the ability to be together, like each other, and act like it.
Mm-hmm. So small group as a particular place where times of bonding, whether that's serious conversations or playing bocce ball, those kinds of things, especially as they build connections that you don't make otherwise in this kind of a setting. And that's one of the purposes of those small groups. What else is a community? Including outside the community, like us interacting with our larger community.
What? People over for supper or a random lunch.
Okay. Hosting.
Mm-hmm. I think simply being present.
Simply being present, where little moments of joy and happiness can emerge. I think often when I think about things I want to do or don't want to do, I decide ahead of time how great of an experience it's going to be. And frequently when you're in a moment with people where beautiful moments can emerge, those are not the ones that are planned.
Mm-hmm. But they are Instagrammed, right? The study, this little quick little aside, the study, the Dr. Larry Santos talked to a number of people who have kind of unique, not really tourist attractions. One of them was an ice cream shop with it that has like a tour you take through it. A very eclectic, just kind of unashamedly joyful experience. The problem is that some of the best moments in that little museum eventually became jammed with people taking that perfect Instagram shot, because it was a really good restaurant. It was a museum of ice cream is what it's called, actually. And eventually word got around. And now they're dealing with this, what they created to bring happiness to people is going the other way. People are standing there anxious about getting the right chance to get the perfect shot. So they are trying to be creative with things like free admission, but you leave your phone here at the desk, and things like that. I mean, if there's a beautiful dish of food, but it wasn't photographed, did it really exist? I've done this too. Doesn't make it right, but. I wanted to mention a couple of the sources that people suggested. A book called Aggressively Happy by Joy Clarkson. I did not get a chance to read because I asked for this kinds of suggestions too late. I think that came from Sherilyn. Desiring God by John Piper, as well as The Other Half of Church by Wilder and Hendricks, both from Twyla Miller. That I would throw out there as suggestions. If you want to listen to the podcast I was listening to, it's called The Happiness Lab by Dr. Larry Santos. I'm finding it interesting and thought-provoking. My challenge for each of us is, and I want to make myself very clear, I am not lifting up happiness here, and I don't think the goal of the topic selection committee, whoever that was, the goal was not to reaffirm that life, liberty, and happiness of pursuit are unalienable rights ordained of God, and therefore we should pursue happiness. We're seeing that it doesn't actually work to pursue that, first of all. So we pursue wholeness as God created us to be. And one of the ways I think we can do that is pay attention. What is my general state of well-being telling me about how well I'm doing in living into the image of God? Thank you.